I'm Ray Bassett, and today on Scenic Roots, farmers markets.
Farmers, we are definitely characters in our own right. You know, we want to not go the commercial route, and we like to live off the land, so we're kind of a little Luddite, you know, a little crazy in a good way.
Fracking rules in Georgia.
He says he gets that we need natural gas for making electricity. Like many, he worries what would happen to the stone his house is perched on should fracking ever come to these mountains.
Barry Corder.
When I conceived this podcast, several months ago, I always knew arts, music, and entertainment were going to be part of it, but I also knew that food was going to be a component.
And Little Shop of Horrors.
And what other show is out there really that has a man-eating plant?
These voices and more today on Scenic Roots. The news is next. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Jessie Gant Temple calls herself a first-generation farmer, and she knows plenty about farmers markets in Chattanooga and the Tennessee Valley. She wrote a recent piece for The Pulse, the alternative news weekly in Chattanooga, about farmers markets in this area, present and past, from the popular to, did you know about this one? Jessie, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Nice to be inside in air conditioning.
Right, because you are, by your own words, a first-generation farmer. Mm-hmm. How did you get into that?
Actually, when I moved to Chattanooga. So my grandparents were farmers, tobacco farmers, and even small-time farmers, tomatoes, like small plots. So then with my parents, it was grocery store. What, grocery store started in like 1952,
something
early
like
60s?
That.
Yeah. So that trend started, and so I joked, I didn't even realize till earlier this year that my mom actually planted fake flowers in our yard. So that's kind of my agricultural background.
And where was this again that
this,
you grew up?
In Maryland, in like just outside of Annapolis between Baltimore and D.C. So again, you know, lots of farms, not so much. Western Maryland, which is where my husband is from, he grew up on a farm. And so a little backstory, we met through roller derby, he and I, in the Carolinas. And he was ready to get away from the beach, and he took a job offer here in Chattanooga in 2014. We found this fantastic land out in Soddy Daisy, 18 acres, found it on Craigslist. I was like, did we just buy a house on Craigslist? But it came with a hot tub and a pool and a greenhouse and 6 blueberry bushes.
Mm.
And we moved here, like I said, in 2014, bought the farm in 2016. Started volunteering at Crabtree Farms, which is a fantastic nonprofit farm right in the heart of the city, and have been going ever since. But I have burned hard-boiled eggs several times. I kill aloe. You can sunburn aloe. So as far as any kind of farming, agricultural, gardening, potted plant, chia pet, skills are in the negative. Barely a first-generation farmer.
But you're all over farmers markets. And
yeah.
I saw the piece that you wrote recently in The Pulse. And it was a great introduction to farmers markets in this area and how they've grown in recent years. And also the ones that people may not have heard about.
Yeah. So we've had the farm for going on 3 years. I just started selling at the Main Street Farmers Market last year. And it really started to educate me about everybody's organic this and non-GMO. And I get that. But if you really focus more on the local, so buying local versus non-soy, non-GMO, organic, whatever. The Chattanooga Sunday Market is fantastic. And I did briefly mention that in the article. But that's a different energy. That's a different vibe. So since we've bought our farm and I'm starting to look at supporting local, eating better, I haven't had fast food in like 6 months. I really started looking at not just from a business perspective of how do we sell our product, but where do I get local milk and cheese and bread? I'm still trying to find local peanut butter and limes and rum, but that's different. So, but really, how do you find your grocery store fix without going to the grocery store? So being a vendor at the Main Street Farmers Market, I kind of got an in. I didn't want to write the article from a vendor perspective, though, but I really wanted to give some vendor insight to consumers on how to be more knowledgeable when you go to farmers markets, what questions to ask them.
So what are a few things that people should keep in mind?
So if someone is going to a farmer's market for the first time, they need to understand what experience they want to have. So some good things to think about. Do you need to take a cooler? Right? Are you trying to buy local meat, local fish? I got a fish guy coming in from like 200 miles. So that's kind of regional. Anyway, so do you need a cooler is a good one. Number two, are you going for like an experience? Do you want to have food trucks and mimosas and crafts? Or are you trying to get some grocery shopping done and get to know the local food movement? And then I talked about in the article how tough it is for not only the vendor, but the customer to get to a farmer's market. So we have over 20 farmer's markets in this area from like Ringgold to Saudi. And we have the convenience of grocery stores that are open almost 24/7.
And yet we have the problem of food deserts here.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so the farmers have to make an effort to set up at the farmer's market, but the customer has to make an effort too. The Main Street Farmer's Market is on Wednesday, middle of the week, from 4 to 6. Kind of a tough time. So most people like a Saturday farmer's market or Sunday, and the Chattanooga Sunday market is huge. But with the Chattanooga Sunday market, although there are local beef and farmers, it's still a different environment. So like I said, the first question to ask is what kind of experience are you looking for? And then what days can you go? So the two Saturday markets I mentioned in the article, the Brainerd Farmers Market and the St. Alban Hickson Market. And that one's close to me. So again, just trying to work out your schedule. Do you try to hit a farmer's market during the week? Do you hit it on the weekend with the family? Do you make an experience out of it? Also, they should just come and see me. Buy my eggs. So yeah, I think that covers it.
You were talking about just a moment ago, and also in the piece, the markets that not everybody knows about. You devoted particular attention to the ones that may be off the beaten path or off the radar entirely. Mm-hmm. And I think that those are worth talking about.
Yeah, the few farmers markets that I mentioned, or just the small farmers markets that I mentioned, the smaller ones are nonprofit. Signal Mountain Farmers Market, again, they're on Thursday. The Main Street Farmers Market, a lot of them are nonprofit, so they don't have paid employees to help promote and get the word out and let people know that they're there. And so somebody running their social media or a website, that doesn't always happen. And so that's why I like the print and radio, of course, to get the word out. And so there are a couple of venues too that supply local produce at a one-stop shop. Bread and Butter, they sell at the Main Street Farmers Market with me. They set up a little produce stand in their Red Bank storefront. So there's some opportunities too to get market product, but not at the farmer's market. So people do have to do a little bit of legwork. And I mentioned that in the article. How far are you willing to go? Are you willing to travel? Are you willing to do some research? Are you willing to get milk? If you run out of milk on Friday, then do you wait till the next market on Wednesday? Or do you go to the grocery store and buy pasteurized? So they have to make an effort to get out there to the smaller guys.
You also dug into a little bit of history.
Oh yeah, the curb market.
Right. Farmers markets are nothing new in this area. Mm-hmm. There's a history. Tell us a little bit more about the curb.
I have been in Chattanooga, like I said, since 2014. So I had no idea about the curb market. And I had to do some research on that and speaking to some of my local farmers who participated in that. Roy Jones, who sells, he's known for his peaches and his strawberries, but he's like, oh, we would just drive there at night, stay in our truck, get there at 2 or 3 in the morning, and we'd wake up when the customer showed up. And you just started selling when the customer showed up. And he was joking that he, 1 year from corn, was like able to buy a car, you know. And again, this was back in the day. But the research I did, there's a Facebook page, another nonprofit called Chattanooga Has History. And it was so cool, the photos that they had and the comments people were making about the curb market. But besides that, I really couldn't find any other information about the curb market besides the Chattanooga Has History Facebook page. And then just talking to people about their experiences. But it took me back to, will we ever get back to that? It made me think, will there be a market that is just, the market itself is organic? And with that, I learned that the Main Street Farmers Market happened organically. Sequatchie Cove Farm was coming to Main Street back 10 years ago and selling their meat and their CSA and their veggies. And it started evolving and evolving. And Sequatchie Cove Farm started the Main Street Farmers Market. So I feel like that's kind of equivalent. I didn't look into the Chattanooga Sunday Market at all, again, because it's like I make the muscle gesture. You know, they're fantastic and they are nonprofit as well, but they have a team. They source regionally, and there are some other farmers market that source regionally. And the definition of regional, which is like maybe 200 miles, and each person has their own definition of regional. And where the curb market, there was no definition. There was no organic. People just came in and you sold your stuff. Seeing that evolution of a farmer's market from curb to the Sunday market to the Main Street market, it was very eye-opening.
And of course, back in the day, there were characters. Names like Banana Man, Strawberry Man.
Yeah. And the Strawberry Man, that's Roy today. And I'm called the Egg Lady. I'm a character, but I tried to find pictures of the Banana Man and see how much of a character he was. I envisioned that yellow suit, you know. Those characters, it's the relationship building, though. It's getting to know where your food is coming from. And farmers, we are definitely characters in our own right. You know, we want to not go the commercial route, and we like to live off the land. So we're kind of a little Luddite, you know, a little crazy in a good way. But Joel Salatin, nationally known the lunatic farmer, he, again, is a character. So with that article, I really hope that people take the time to search out farmers markets and get to know these local characters or their farmer. And even if it's just one purchase a month or a week, but really starting to source locally, growing the community. I say I'm good at that. I can't grow a chia pet. I can't grow a tomato plant, but I can grow community.
And it's a lot of work. It's hard work. But when it pays off, oh, it's worth it.
Yeah, right now it's blueberry and blackberry season for me. And oh my gosh, which only lasts for about a month, but it is hard work and it's fire ant bites and poison ivy and sunburn. And that's not even the physical labor of it. You know, it's the backbreaking and the twining and staking. And you don't become a farmer to be rich. And so another, I don't want to tell people that not to haggle at the farmer's market, but people need to stop looking at their food as cheap and look at it as more valuable. And, you know, a $6 rotisserie chicken that you can pick up at the store, and my chickens, you're paying $6 a pound. But again, it's, you shouldn't eat cheaply. So like I said, I feel really good. I'm on this whole, my next article is about not eating fast food and where do you find like your sweets and your chocolate by supporting local. Like I said, not necessarily customers haggling, but I'll throw in the more you buy, the better the deal. But the more you go, the more of a relationship you grow with your farmer, with your farmer's market. And it's a priceless experience, if you will.
Right. Yeah. More to come through the rest of the summer.
Oh, yeah. There are the Signal Mountain farmers, most of the farmer's market, the Brainerd one, the Main Street farmer's market is all year. Most farmer's markets are 12 months long, but they just decrease their hours. So tomato season right now, goodness gracious, tomatoes and peppers. And people should know that you shouldn't have tomatoes in March and you shouldn't have peaches in September. So I tried to eat seasonally, but that was really tough because I wanted a pineapple in December. So instead I'm like, well, if I eat locally, and that was kind of easier for me to comprehend. Because again, I'm eating like cinnamon rolls, but I'm getting those locally. But most farmers markets go year long.
Jesse, thanks for the article. Thanks for your time.
Yeah.
Look forward to having you back on here.
Once my season's over, I would love to come back.
Looking forward to it.
Thank you so
Take
much.
Care.
Thank you.
Jesse Gant Temple. You can find her piece about farmers markets at ChattanoogaPulse.com. The natural gas that Georgia relies on to make electricity comes from out of state. There's lots of gas trapped in the rock of northwest Georgia, but for now, Georgia's gas reserves are likely to stay in the ground, thanks to a culture of property rights and new state regulations. Grant Blankenship of GPB News explains.
Rome, Georgia, like that other Rome, is a city of three rivers.
In this case, the Usanala and Etowah come together downtown to make the Kusa. That's where I meet Larry Lassiter, walking his black lab, Fiona.
It's a really nice area up here.
He says he gets that we need natural gas for making electricity.
Do it in a manner that doesn't destroy, you know, your private property.
Like many, he worries what would happen to the stone his house is perched on should fracking ever come to these mountains. Natural gas permeates rock shale the way water fills a sponge. Fracking is when fluids are pumped at enormous pressure into shale formations to break them up and free the gas.
It's kind of like taking a car and shaking it. That's what it's doing to the ground.
Once the shaking is over and the rock is shattered, natural gas can sometimes get into underground aquifers, which in northwest Georgia can flow to the Coosa River Basin. It's the gas-rich Conasauga Shale that runs under northwest Georgia. Jerry Spalvieri, a natural gas prospector from Oklahoma, was one of the people who first suggested to Georgians they could make money from gas trapped in their land. He says at first they were excited. Then word spread and the winds shifted. Spalvieri says people got afraid of the word fracking.
I had to do town hall meetings, and you know, we had 100 people at the Rome Library.
People wanted to know that their land, and in many cases the water in their private wells, would be safe if their neighbors decided to drill.
They were legitimately concerned about what this would mean for water quality.
That's Jesse DeMombrian Chapman of the Coosa River Basin Initiative, an environmental advocacy group. He organized those town halls and was instrumental in creating what are now Georgia's new fracking regulations. But first, he had to argue fracking should even be regulated. Northwest Georgia is deeply conservative and, at least in the last election, very supportive of Donald Trump, who is bullish on fossil fuels. DeMombrian Chapman says he'd forgive you for thinking opposing fracking wouldn't go well here.
We would have been branded, you know, that very left-leaning group, you know, spreading lies about fracking.
Instead, he took another tack.
We made this a private landowner issue.
Remember Larry Lassiter down by the river?
Do it in a manner that doesn't destroy, you know, your private property.
DeMombrian Chapman convened all the Larry Lassiters worried about their homes and their water in those town halls. And because fracking on one farm could contaminate a well on the farm next door, he argued fracking rules for all could protect individual property rights.
Framed that way, everybody all of a sudden is like, well, absolutely, that should be, you know, everyone's right.
The problem was that Georgia's oil and gas rules were passed in 1970 before fracking was even a thing. So job one, define fracking. After that, April Lipscomb, attorney with the Southern Environmental Law Center, says lawmakers added transparency for landowners into how drilling permits would be granted.
And included in that are things like requiring groundwater monitoring before, during, and after fracking activities.
In other parts of the country, city or county governments have been locked out of the fracking permitting process.
Our law does the exact opposite. It explicitly allows local governments to do more.
For instance, Dade County already has an outright ban on fracking. Prospector Jerry Spalvieri has cooled a bit on northwest Georgia.
It's no gold rush because the pricing's not that good.
And until the market changes, gas is still trapped in the Conasauga Shale. For GPB News, I'm Grant Blankenship in Macon.
Our own Will Davis joins us to introduce us to a new podcast partner for Scenic Roots and WUTC. Welcome, Will.
Hi, Ray. Today's podcast partner is People with Barry Corder. And Barry Corder is a newspaper guy. He's from the Times Free Press, and he started this podcast about 8 months ago because he said there was oftentimes more to the story than just 20 inches in a newspaper. And so in this podcast, he talks to people that he finds interesting that he's met through his work as a reporter at the Times Free Press. What Barry likes about podcasting, he says, is that it's the wild, wild west, you know, which is something that a lot of people like about podcasting. The story is as long as it has to be. The interview is as long as it has to be. There's a lot of freedom and flexibility in podcasting, and Barry is really kind of taken to that. In this episode, he's talking to Dan Rose and Max Popple, who are the guys behind the Crash Pad, the hostel, and the Flying Squirrel, the restaurant in the South Side, about those two businesses and how they're related and how the South Side has changed and how it's changing in tourism. It's a really interesting conversation.
All right, let's listen.
People are strange.
People get ready.
People. People who need people.
Shining happy people.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to People with Barry Quarter. When I conceived this podcast, several months ago, I always knew arts, music, and entertainment were going to be part of it, but I also knew that food was going to be a component. Why? Well, because I like to eat. We all like to eat. But I'm also married to a foodie of the highest degree. I've only seen her read one book that wasn't a cookbook. I won't say which book, but it surprises me to this day. But anyway, I'm aware of food and cooking and its role in our culture. And I knew that there were several chefs and restaurateurs and owners in our area that I wanted to talk to for this podcast. And I have two of those guys with me today. Max Popple and Dan Rose are here. They've joined me in the 1921 Society Lounge in the beautiful Tivoli Theater. But anyway, Max and Dan, you'll hear, I met them probably back around 2009, 2010. They were just about to open the Crash Pad, which is a hostel for basically the people who come to this area to enjoy what we have to offer in the outdoors: kayaking, boating, biking, hiking, rock climbing, skydiving, hang gliding. Anyway, as I hoped it would be, it's a fascinating conversation, and I hope you guys think so as well. We are in the 1921 Society Lounge in the Tivoli, a cool space that they're kind enough to let me use. It's pretty neat, isn't it?
Yeah, this is awesome.
Yeah, I didn't know this was here. It's beautiful.
It's fairly new. It's only a month or two, maybe.
No kidding.
But it's pretty...
Well, good work, Tivoli.
It was a storage space.
Looks like it's been here forever.
Speaking of, you guys, we're going to jump all over because that's the way my brain works. Mm-hmm. But let's try to start somewhat at the beginning. You guys started with the Crash Pad.
Mm-hmm.
You were what, living in New York?
We went to school in upstate New York. Both of us are from the Boston area suburbs, yeah.
And it was mountain climbing and it brought you here, right?
Yeah, rock climbing, exactly. Yeah, we moved down here in the end of 2005. We definitely arrived kind of accidentally in the bar restaurant business as far as moving down here, you know, driven by the outdoor access and the promise of a new cool city to explore. And it wasn't until both of us had been here for years that we even started talking about opening up a business. And at that point, even then, it was to cater to climbers like us.
Right. I remember, I think we met, what, at Burger Place, right? I think it was the first time.
Way back.
Jeez,
test our memory there.
Mm-hmm. I know, I had to think about it too. And I remember you telling me about the idea for the Crash Pad, a hostel catering mm-hmm. to climbers.
Yeah, and you thinking it was really stupid?
No, I remember thinking, and I still think, how had that not been done before?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we asked ourselves that question a lot as well.
And we got that question a lot from people that we spoke to, like, oh, you know, I had the idea to do it, just haven't done it. Or like, yeah, it's great, like, obvious idea, crazy it hasn't been here before.
Yeah, I mean, all the factors were lined up in our favor, including having a city that was totally willing and ready to embrace these, adventure tourists, as it were, as like a real economic driver and a real part of the city.
I have mentioned on this podcast, as a matter of fact, to me, the renaissance of this city happened, and you guys are a big, big part of it, when city leaders, civic leaders sort of looked around and said, you know what, all of these climbers, bikers, kayakers, hang gliders, they also like to eat.
Sure.
I mean, it seems mm-hmm. so obvious, but it wasn't.
Yeah, if they're going to travel here and be here for a week or 2 days or whatever it is, I mean, they're not just going to...
And they also like to be entertained.
Yeah.
And so that to me is when the city started packaging everything together instead of trying to, you know, just target their marketing towards bikers or
sure.
climbers.
It's a complete mm-hmm. vacation experience now.
Having said all that, we're at a place in the city. We had a conversation a while ago that it continues to shift, doesn't it? The mm-hmm. whole scene continues to shift.
Absolutely.
And the bar restaurant scene, as we've already said, is tough.
Mm-hmm.
You mm-hmm. it can change. It does change, right? You had a good week. I think one of you said just because we had a good Wednesday doesn't guarantee mm-hmm. we're going to have a good Saturday, right?
Yeah, yeah.
What are the challenges? What's the challenge now? What'd you say? 6 years later?
Mm-hmm. It's a extremely unpredictable business night by night anyway, especially considering the population density right around us. I think that's a big factor. I mean, we've got thousands of apartments being built, but right now it feels like there are more restaurants and bars than there are people to pack them all out every night. And so to your point you just made, if we have a really busy Wednesday, that doesn't mean much about Saturday necessarily, but it does probably mean we're going to have a slow Thursday or that we're coming off of a slow Tuesday. There aren't that many people who are fans of our restaurant who will come in there enthusiastically and pack it out one night and then all come back the next night. We just don't really see that happen that much. It helps that we see over the last couple of years way more tourists coming down to our side of town. That has definitely buffered it and leveled it out a little bit. But we're not at that point where all the area restaurants are busy all the time simply because of their location, even though I believe that day is ahead of us somewhere.
There's just a lot more quality competition now. When we opened up, there were far fewer places. If you said, I want to go get a nice meal and a nice drink, yeah, there were spots. But if you look at how many have opened since, and clearly I don't have any numbers to back this up, but I mean, there's just a lot. If you want to go out for great food and drink, the scene in Chattanooga has grown, and it's great. There are a lot more options.
Right. Mm-hmm. What about identity? I think we talked before.
So my other answer to your question, hard to keep up with and always is and has been a challenge, is just the culture in general. When we started with Crash Pad, we had 3 employees while we were embarking on the designing and building process with Flying Squirrel. And, you know, through that year-ish, we had inadvertently created a culture and figured out what's important to us and how we want to run businesses, our underlying business principles. Then we're staring at, or we're about to go from 3 to 30 employees overnight. We've built this way we like to do business. How in the heck do we maintain that? Mm-hmm. So we looked at designing our Crash Pad Hospitality course, which basically the first day in the restaurant, everybody front and back of house was out front, and it was 2 sessions on Crash Pad Hospitality. How do we treat each other? How do we treat our guests? The general underlying philosophy of how we're going to do business, and all our businesses are in the hospitality business. So there are these, you know, underlying principles to them all. So you put all that emphasis on the front end, get everybody psyched and trained up. It's very challenging to keep up with that as you go and have ongoing kind of training. You know, ultimately it comes down to living it every day, right? But it can't hurt to have the refreshers. And you know, as soon as you're not paying attention to it, it swerves in a way that you're not expecting and takes a while to kind of get it back. And then you realize you have all these new people and you haven't talked to them about this stuff. So that
turnover is, to Max's point about culture and keeping the culture strong and keeping everybody on the same page, turnover on our staff is far and away the biggest obstacle to having that be a easy path.
I promise you, you're not alone.
Yeah.
I've told this story many, many times. My brother owned Pizza Pizza.
Oh, I love Pizza Pizza.
Yeah, man, miss that place. Yeah.
Shout out to that cheesy pasta they had. Oh, amazing. That cheese wad.
Mm. The Greek salad, mm-hmm. The Brainerd burrito.
Mm. Oh, I'm sad now.
I'm sad and hungry. And hungry.
But his staffing was his biggest issue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he had one guy went up on the roof to smoke a joint and fell through the skylight.
Mm-hmm.
And
at least he can't claim workers' comp.
Didn't understand why he was fired.
Uh-huh.
You know, he had 2 people on a beautiful spring day, didn't show up, came in the next day, and Scott's like, they said, dude, it was gorgeous out. We went to the lake. Didn't call, you know, expected to clock in the next mm-hmm. day. I guess it was rainier the next day. But mm-hmm. those kinds of stories I hear all the time.
Yeah.
That was Barry Corder and his podcast People with Barry Corder. And he was talking to Dan Rose and Max Poppel, the guys behind the Crash Pad and the Flying Squirrel in the South Side. People is one of WTC's podcast partners, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks, Will, for another podcast partner and for Tennessee Valley StoryCorps, which you bring us every Tuesday here on WUTC.
Thanks, Ray.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More after our news with Bill McLean. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Tonight, author Margaret Renkel will appear in Chattanooga at a public conversation at Starline Books. Renkel is based in Nashville, where she sat down recently with Emily Siner of WPLN News.
Margaret Renkel wants you to know that loss is universal. But especially in her own Southern family, there's something therapeutic about keeping memories alive with stories.
I don't think that anyone is ever really completely dead in the South. I think that we carry our people with us.
The Nashville-based writer, perhaps best known for her regular columns in the New York Times, explores that idea in her debut book. It's called Late Migrations, and it weaves together short, poetic essays into a narrative about coming to terms with grief. I talked to Renkel in our studio. Margaret Renkel, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
This book has a lot of stories about the births and deaths of your family members. But in between, you write these vignettes about the natural world that you're observing outside your window. And so I'm wondering to start if you could read part of the first of these observational stories.
The first year, a day before the baby bluebirds were due to hatch, I checked the nest box just outside my office window and found a pinprick in one of the eggs. Believing it must be the pip that signals the beginnings of a hatch, I quietly closed the box and resolved not to check again right away, though the itch to peek was nearly unbearable. I've been waiting years for a family of bluebirds to take up residence in that box, and finally an egg was about to shudder and pop open. 2 days later, I realized I hadn't seen either parent in some time, so I checked again and found all 5 eggs missing. The nest was undisturbed. The cycle of life might as well be called the cycle of death. Everything that lives will die, and everything that dies will be eaten. Bluebirds eat insects, snakes eat bluebirds, hawks eat snakes, owls eat hawks. That's how wildness works, and I know it. I was heartbroken anyway.
I feel like I grew up reading Charlotte's Web and The Wind in the Willow and All the Animals Are Friends in those books, but that's not realistic. Like, how did you think about the natural world as a child?
I must have, at some level, thought of nature in those kind of, I guess, cartoonish terms. But in real life, it was clear to me that that was not how the natural world worked. You don't have to spend very much time in nature, especially as a child, to see that if somebody steps on another bug, all the ants are going to carry it away by bits. You know, you don't have to spend very long in the woods to see that the salamanders are eating the frog eggs. So I guess I did what children do, and I assumed that what happened in storybooks was one thing and what happened in real life was another.
Why did you feel like it was important to document all of these observations of the cycle of life in this book?
When I started writing the first of the essays that make up this book, my mother had just died. My mother-in-law was in hospice care. And it was just overwhelming to me how all of this was coming together to just remind me on a daily basis, like a tolling bell, that time is running out. And yet, there was all this life outside the window. And I just was feeling that if I concentrated on that life, if I forced myself to see this rat snake coming out of the chickadee nest box and the crow stealing the cardinal's babies, then I would stop feeling so singled out for suffering. You know, it's just what happens. And what happens is not evil. It's just what happens.
You have a story in here that really stuck with me about what you saved when you were cleaning up your mother's house. Could you read a few of those paragraphs?
Sure. I saved the nicest of the towels, filling 2 closets, but none of the fabric remnants piled in the guest room, and none of the garish rhinestone brooches from the 50s, and none of the Jane Austen fan fiction, and none of the Southern Living magazines from the 80s, and none of the Hallmark Channel DVDs. The retirement home, the one you almost moved into, was grateful to have the DVDs. The retirement home, you would be glad to know, has finally gotten rid of the bed bugs. I saved all 5 giant boxes of OxyClean, and oh my God, why did you never tell me about OxyClean? At 156 loads per box, our socks have been white for all the years you've been gone. I saved 3 lipsticks and a shade of pink I will never wear, but I threw away 2 dozen more, along with bottle after bottle of expired vitamins, and don't even get me started on the expired boxes and cans in the pantry. I wish I had known how much you loved blueberry muffins. I wish I had made you blueberry muffins every day of your life.
It sounded like you were so disappointed that she didn't pass on this knowledge of OxyClean and the blueberry muffins, and it made me think about the things that mothers or other people that we care about, like, don't think is important enough to pass on.
Yeah. there's so many things when I think about my own children. What have I not mentioned to them? You know, my oldest son is 27 and he read the book. He said, you know, so many of these stories you've never said. And I didn't realize I had never told them those stories. I mean, I tell stories all the time. Southerners tell stories. That's what we do. But apparently not all of them.
Author Margaret Renkel, speaking with Emily Siner of WPLN News in Nashville. Renkel appears in Chattanooga tonight at Starline Books at 6:30 p.m. for a public conversation with fellow author Jamie Quattro. Tomorrow night, the musical Little Shop of Horrors opens at Chattanooga Theater Center. Maggie Hudgens is the director. Garrett Henson Hink plays Seymour, the flower shop worker. And Jenna Rayborn plays Audrey, Seymour's co-worker and crush. Oh, and then there's Audrey, too. That would be the man-eating plant that wants to take over the world.
I've loved this show for a really long time. I love the kind of offbeat comedy that it has. I love the paradoxes that are involved throughout the show. It's talking about a man-eating plant while you're kind of snapping to a doo-wop beat, which is kind of fun.
Never goes out of style.
How can it? So the parody and the satire drew me to it. So when I knew they were doing it at the theater center, I kind of talked to Todd a little bit and said, is there any way I could be involved with this show? I'd love to do it. And luckily, I got the job.
Even for something that doesn't go out of style and it's been around quite a while and comes back again and again, there's always something new to grapple with and putting it on the stage.
Well, I guess we start the way we'd start with any production with the kind of smaller moments, and then we start putting all those small moments together as we get new pieces in. So Donnell, who's the voice of Audrey 2, would kind of start out on stage, and there are a couple of rehearsals where Donnell and Garrett were actually playing off of each other. Even though we don't see Donnell, we see Garrett with a big puppet. So I think you were happy to get the puppet in there.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a whole new experience. I mean, from that first rehearsal with Donnell of interacting with just a person, but then envisioning this massive plant that comes to life with someone else inside of it. It's awesome to kind of interact with something new like that, that you've never gotten the opportunity to interact with on stage before. And what other show is out there really that has a man-eating plant?
And instead of two people, then we have a third person involved. So the lines are being interpreted three different ways through the voice, and then the voice working off of Garrett, and then there's a puppeteer in the center of it who's listening to the voice and then manifesting the physicality. What's so beautiful about it is they all do such a great job of listening to each other and watching each other and responding. It's a very much a give and take. It's really fun to watch in rehearsal, actually.
And then you bring that give and take on stage with the characters that both of you play.
Absolutely. Outside of the plant, of course, there's the romantic relationship that grows from Seymour's success of feeding the man-eating plant. You know, his fame and success comes, and then eventually a romantic relationship with Audrey. And that blossoms throughout the show. You have to come see the ending. I don't want to give too many spoilers away. But yeah, there's the typical interactions of on the stage with other characters in the cast as well.
And Jenna?
I'm treated very poorly by my boyfriend in the first act, and with Seymour being very successful, or getting very successful, I see him as like a hero, and he kind of saves me. So I do fall in love with him, and I think actually I love him the whole time. It's just with the situation I'm in, I physically can't until I see how he is, or what the plant made him.
Right.
So.
This just taps into age-old stories, long before talking plants, although I'm sure there are probably some stories back in antiquity about talking plants that we just haven't quite discovered yet.
Well, I think everybody can identify with the idea of the everyman trying to move forward in life or getting something that they wish they could have, going for a better life, as we talk about that all the time. So it's kind of like, what if we had people who were in a really bad situation to start with, really reaching for what we would consider just an average life, really. And that's what Audrey sings about. You know, I really just want a nice little house and a nice little picket fence and a toaster, and that's it. And so they get this opportunity through this fantastic situation, which I don't know how that turns out. But
that's left to the imagination, as it should be.
Yes.
We'd like to hear a little bit of it right now.
Sure.
You know, sometimes I think Mr. Mushnick's too hard on you. Oh, I don't mind. After all, I owe him everything. He took me out of the Skid Row home for the boys when I was just a little tyke. Gave me a warm place to sleep, under the counter. Nice things to eat, like meatloaf and water. Floors to sweep and toilets to clean and every other Sunday off.
You know, I think you ought to raise your expectations, Seymour. Now that we're getting successful, I mean. Why don't you start with some new clothes? No offense, but with all the interviews and photo sessions, a big, important experimental botanist has to look the part.
I'm a very bad shopper, Audrey. I don't have good taste, like you.
Well, I could help you pick things out.
You could?
Sure.
You'd go shopping with me?
Sure.
You'd be seen in a public place, like a department store, with me?
Sure.
Tonight?
I can't tonight. I've got a date, but I'd like to go with you some other time.
Sure. I'll pencil you in.
I'll bet you get a lot of dates now, huh?
Not dates exactly, but a lot of gardening clubs been calling asking me to give lectures.
Gee.
Imagine me giving lectures. I never even finished grade school.
That doesn't matter. You have life experience.
Some experience. I don't even know what it's like to fly in an airplane.
Me neither.
Or eat a fancy dinner at Howard Johnson's.
Me neither.
Or ride a motorcycle.
Oh, it's no big deal, and besides, it's dangerous.
It is?
Extremely dangerous. Now, I better go fix my face. My date will be here any minute.
Well done. I was just thinking about how much escapism is in this story. That's something that comes in and out of season as well. Maybe that's part of the appeal behind this work.
Absolutely. I think a lot of the reason myself, and maybe I'm speaking for other people, but a lot of the reason we're getting involved in these productions is to kind of tap out of your own world. I mean, there is so much involved in a production that you can find those relatable moments, and we want to relate those characters to the audience as well. But I mean, you're giving yourself each night of rehearsal a few hours to get out of your everyday life. And then even in production, just kind of tapping out of what you're doing on the daily to kind of escape from those situations and walk in someone else's shoes.
Well, Audrey doesn't do anything but think about what if, what could be. And she yearns for something better. And that's what makes it so fun to be her, is that I come in and I'm this trapped person, and then I get to imagine what life could be. And you know, every person imagines that, even when they live a supposedly normal life, they always imagine, you know, what if. And so that's what's so fun, is that I get to think about myself in those situations to kind of make it more realistic. What if I had something better? What if I could do something to improve myself? And it also is so fun because you really learn from the characters you play. I learned not to take people for granted because she lives such a horrible life. And so I learned it's always better what you have. And so I love this character. I think this is my dream character. So being her is so amazing.
I'm a huge monster movie fan. So recreating those old B sci-fi monster movies, so awesome. I don't know. Do you guys feel like you're in a monster movie?
Yeah.
I mean, how much fun is that, you know? She's actually in a white gown. We do a lot of silhouettes, and a lot of the monster opens its mouth really wide, and that's just really fun for me. I've had a great time trying to throw in a whole bunch of references that I hope people who follow that will kind of notice and see. So that's escapism for me as well. It's just fun. A parody of it is a lot of fun. And then commenting on itself, doing that, makes the jokes. So.
Well, Maggie, Jenna, Garrett, thank you, and all the best.
Thank you.
Little Shop of Horrors opens tomorrow night at 8 p.m. at Chattanooga Theater Center. You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. Our show is produced by Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, Abby Lusk, and Will Davis from the studios of WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Follow us on Twitter at ScenicRoots423 and email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. We're back tomorrow at 3 p.m., and we leave you with Alex Williams playing at Songbirds on Saturday night in Chattanooga. Join us again next time for Scenic Roots.
was told not long gone. My songs are better than myself. Someone told me not long ago. My songs are better than myself. That the reckless way I'm living, it don't match my melodies. That the written words I'm singing, they ain't got no honesty. It's all candy from a jukebox that's burning down in hell. They said my songs are better than myself. Well, I was told not long ago that my songs are better than myself. 'Cause if a song comes from the heart, then my heart must be stronger than my health. But I'll stay up till the sunrise just looking for a rhyme. And I like getting drunk until it's just about showtime. Some nights upon this stage, I'm a hard act to sell. Think out my songs better than myself.